For us is Pelman versus the people, and we're ready to hear from the petition.
Good morning, Elizabeth McClintock, representing Mark Pelman, the petitioner in this matter. The issue before the court is the statutory interpretation of the position of trust statute. Specifically, what does the statute mean with the modifying language at the end of the statute that says that any unlawful act must be occurring at the time that the actor is in a position of trust? What Mr. Pelman is seeking from this court is a decision that reflects the Court of Appeals division decision in People v. Johnson, where we have a bright line interpretation of the statute that indicates what the statute says is exactly what the plain meaning of the words are. They must be in a position of trust at the time that the unlawful act occurred. The Court of Appeals in Mr. Pelman's case did not follow that reasoning. Rather, they said that an argument that if Mr. Pelman was a trusted family friend, that if he was a member of the church in which LB attended and in which her father was the minister, then because he was trusted by the family, he was in a position of trust. However,
the Court of Appeals really challenged whether it had to be at that point in time, or are you instead simply arguing that they misapplied the facts to that standard, or misapplied that standard to the facts?
No, I believe that their opinion in Pelman did say that it did not have to be at that particular time. They were saying, we are not going to adopt Mr. Pelman's argument that is mechanical in reasoning, that it can be turned off and on like a light switch.
If they disagreed, then.
Yes, I do. I believe that they interpreted the statute much more broadly and in the same manner that the trial court did in this case, that they allowed the prosecution to argue for a time period far, far outside what was charged in the information and complaint, and to allege that facts that occurred far before any unlawful act occurred could be used to convict Mr. Pelman of this crime.
Excuse me. What's wrong with that in terms of determining whether that person had a position of trust with the child? I mean, why can't you go back to whatever they went back to many years?
Well, first,
I don't understand why that's inadmissible.
First, I would say that you have a charging document that lists a time period for which the actions of the defendant are alleged to be criminal in nature. So if you're going to charge a time period that includes actions that occurred, you should charge the time period as a broader time period. If you're going to be talking about actions that occurred far outside of the dates that are charged in the document.
Doesn't that really make sense? Aren't we just talking about the status of the defendant, that he was a person in a position of trust? And wouldn't it be similar to an incest case where you're alleging that the defendant is related to the victim? You certainly don't have to put that in a charging document. I mean, the how far back that occurred.
No, because there's a familial relationship there that can be proven.
Right.
I mean, that's a blood relation or something of that nature.
It doesn't have to be charged in the sense that you're talking about here. Why isn't position of trust similar?
Actually, I think in incest, I think it does have to be charged. I think they have to allege exactly what the familial relationship is.
Yes, but they don't have to do it. You're arguing that I thought in the charging document you have to state something about an allegation of when the position of trust began?
Yes, because the statute itself says that the actor has to be in a position of trust at the time that the unlawful act occurred. Position of trust is not an ongoing, position.
Why is that?
You can be in a position of trust to a child at one point and then not at another. In this case, argument was that at one point, Mr. Pelman was in a position of trust. We have conceded that when he was a chaperone on the Elitch trip, At that point in time, he's in a position of trust. He is one of the two adults that is chaperoning these underage children, and he has a duty to those children. However, once the children are returned to their parents, he is no longer in a position of trust to those children. If any one of us took on the responsibility of chaperoning a field trip for a school or any type of event, that does not mean that we are then forever in a position of trust to those children. We do not owe them any parental duties. It is only when those children are entrusted to our care that we owe them parental duties.
Is the teacher in a position of trust outside of the classroom?
Well, if you have a teacher situation, first of all, that's completely different because you have an ongoing type of a relationship. If you're talking about a teacher who sees a student in the morning...
Okay, why isn't this an ongoing type of relationship? Why is it that you're defining this relationship as being very specific and limited in time, whereas a teacher relationship has some greater ongoing
Because there's aspect. Ongoing contact between the child and the teacher. If you see a teacher during the day, their duties don't necessarily end. They are lessened. But if you're seeing the child the very next day, you have the same duties. In this situation, Mr. Pellman was not in that type of a position.
And so would your teacher be in the position of trust when the teacher runs into the child at Walmart?
Would I expect a teacher to take on parental responsibilities? No. However,
so if the abuse occurs,
if the teacher is going to be abusing the child at the Walmart, say in the afternoon after school is out, I think the argument can be made that you have an ongoing relationship there, and the time frame that would need to be charged.
So perhaps here you don't have an ongoing relationship factually,
right?
Maybe, but why can't you make that argument? Why isn't that a question of fact, whether you have an ongoing relationship here, or whether, as you indicate, it has come to an end?
Why, if the DA were to make that argument and were to charge the time frames, yes, I suppose they could make that argument.
Can I take you back to the statute?
Sure.
Because you kept saying it is at the time. Mm-hmm. Where do you get that? I'm looking at the definition of sexual assault.
Right.
And also the definition of position of trust.
Yes.
So where do you get the at the time of?
At the very end of 18.3.4.1 3.5, at the very end of that statute, it talks about one is in a position of trust, includes, and comma, but not limited to, and it talks about people that are in the role of parents or guardians. Then it talks about other people who are charged with the health, education, or welfare of children, and then at the very end of that paragraph, set off by a comma, it indicates, at the time of an unlawful act.
I'm sorry, but so you think that it has to do with that applies to all the factors that are listed here?
Yes, I do. I believe that the fact that it is set off at the end of the paragraph by a comma modifies all the preceding language. I think that's standard statutory interpretation.
And what about the reference in the beginning of that provision about that it's intended to include but not be limited to?
Right.
What do we make with the not be limited to?
That phrase right there, put in parentheses, or excuse me, in commas, but is not limited to, then refers to the next section in which examples are given by the legislature of what it would apply to when it talks about any person who is a parent or acting in the place of a parent or charged with the rights, duties, or responsibilities concerning a child. However, then that section is separated by a comma and an or before the next section.
So you think that's only limited to the first? Isn't that contrary to the usual idea that those are words of inclusion, not limitation?
I don't think that it is. I think what they're saying there is that they can't give you every single example of how that's going to apply. They didn't include situations and specifically name policemen, EMTs, people, doctors, nurses. They did not, you know, specifically go into all of those situations. However, they're trying to give an illustration to say people who act in this type of situation. And it refers more to an example than it does to broadening the scope of when someone can be in a position of trust. That's it. Okay. There are several situations, Justice Martinez, such as what you said, teachers. You have an ongoing relationship there. That was not the case here. We have someone who...
Again, how do you tell whether it's ongoing and treated one way or not ongoing and treated the other way, unless it's just a question of fact?
It would be a question of fact... I guess because the DA would need to allege facts in order to show that, have to allege some kind of situation that someone's status was as a teacher or in an ongoing situation such as a guardian or a step parent or a regular babysitter or something of that
nature. Well, wait a minute.
You seem to be switching the argument and making an argument that there's a deficiency in the charging document. And I thought that this was raised to us and that you initially were just arguing about a statutory interpretation.
That is the only issue that you elected to grant cert on, was on the statutory interpretation of this case. My argument was simply illustrative that if you are going to say someone is in a position of trust and you're going to say that it goes over a long period of time, that yes, you need to charge those dates as well.
You didn't raise an issue about the insufficiency of the charging document, did you?
Yes, I did. To the Court of Appeals, I did.
To us?
Yeah, I believe that it actually was one of the issues that I filed in my petition for cert.
Not saying that. But nonetheless, the...
It went under the unanimity instruction. The argument in there was that they did not require the DA to have them elect which counts and when it happened and what incidents occurred on what dates, and that the information that they were arguing to the jury was outside the time frame charge.
The election argument, you think, is an argument that the charging document is insufficient?
Well, it went to the fact that, no, it wasn't even so much that the charging document was insufficient, but that by the time that it got to the jury, it was so broad that we needed a unanimity instruction and an election of counts in order to make sure we understood.
So exactly. Your charging document in this case, of which you are still arguing that comes somehow is also encompassed in the issue before us, is a matter of it's a broad period of time that they alleged that the position of trust, in which the defendant was in a position of trust.
I would think that if you're going to charge someone with a position of trust, you have to actually prove within the time frame charge that they were in that position, and that was not done here.
What did they charge in the time frame that's wrong?
They charged from July 5th, I believe, until August 23rd, but then they were allowed to argue that because Mr. Pellman had babysat the children, I believe, 5 years prior to that, because he had been a Sunday school teacher 3 years prior to that, because he had been involved in a puppet ministry in 2001, 4 years
ago. You're saying they used evidence that was outside of the charge time?
Yes, significantly, to make the point that he was trusted.
I have difficulty understanding why presenting evidence that comes out of a time frame, mm-hmm. because it may reflect on the status during that time frame, is in some way inappropriate, unless it's just a relevancy argument, which is another matter.
Which I think.
But you seem to say there's something structurally wrong with presenting evidence about a time frame and the nature of the relationship outside of that time frame. The time frame being the one.
Yes,
charged.
Because the statute requires that at the time the unlawful act occurred, the person has to be in a position of trust. So.
But I think you're also asserting that it has to be some kind of recognized status, like parent, minister, and so on.
Yes.
And I'm interested in you commenting on whether or not you're actually saying that the parents can't confer this position of trust under the statutory definition, which arguably is what happened here. They trusted him, and he violated their trust.
I think that if the parents put their child in someone's care, then they can do that.
Why didn't they do that in allowing these unsupervised outings?
They did not do that. And in this case, they specifically stated on the record they did not do that, that they never would have done that. That in all of the contexts that Mr. Pellman had with LB, they specifically made sure that their child was not alone with him or any other male, because they would never feel comfortable in that situation, that they never trusted any male to be alone with any of their children.
Seems to be inconsistent with the evidence.
It's inconsistent with a finding that he was in a position of trust or that they trusted him, when they specifically stated on the record that they didn't and they wouldn't trust any man. I see that I'm out of time. If the court has any other questions, I have no more time for rebuttal, so thank you.
May it please the court, Wendy Ritz representing the people in this matter. The issue that was presented today is whether the Court of Appeals erred in its reading of the position of trust definition. And I have to disagree with the defendant. The defendant suggests that the Court of Appeals didn't really follow the reading of Johnson regarding the requirement that the contact occur at the time that the defendant is in a position of trust. And I think the Court of Appeals followed Johnson, followed the reasoning, and did give effect to that part of the statute, but also more broadly gave effect to the rest of the statute, which suggests that there can be a broader overall relationship in which is in place at the time of the sexual contact. As to the defendant's suggestion that there's a problem with the way this was charged, I think, as this court has pointed out, the fact that it was charged, I think, between July 8th and August 23rd, the allegation is that the defendant was in a position of trust during that period. That's what the evidence established. The fact that they could show the broader context of the relationship with evidence from the past does not in any way undermine the sufficiency of the charging document.
Well, what is the particular evidence during that time period? Let's assume you can introduce a long chain of the relationship being established and she being curried for this illicit sexual conduct. What is the status in that and the facts you rely on within that charge time period?
Sure. The victim, there is testimony generally about the development of the relationship, how it was a family friend, etc., but there's also the victim's testimony outlined exactly what went on that summer, from the beginning of the summer all the way throughout the summer, including the period between July 8th and August 23rd. During that summer, they were both involved in Vacation Bible School together. The defendant was a supervisor for the Vacation Bible School, and the victim was one of the teachers. During that period, they went on a field trip following the Vacation Bible School, and the defendant was a chaperone, and the victim went on the trip, and they spent time alone together, and he kissed her during that period. They spent time together talking, meeting to plan an event for the church involving a bonfire. She met alone with the defendant to plan that event. The defendant hugged and kissed her, I think, during that period. it shows the development and progression of this relationship. It started with the background that this family had known the defendant for years. He was involved in their small, close-knit church community. All that context is significant and necessary to put in context what the jury had to decide. During this period, was the defendant in a position of trust? They had to look back and understand what this relationship was as a whole in order to make that determination. So I don't think there was any problem with admission of this evidence.
Could, sort of along the lines that Justice Martinez was suggesting, you state in your brief that there is no evidence that position of trust relationship ended, right? But I guess there was an argument, I assume, it would be a jury question of whether or not it in fact had ended at the Elitch Gardens. Is that right?
Right. The defendant's argument.
Was that argued in court?
Yes. The defendant throughout has acknowledged that he was involved in a relationship with the victim, that they had sexual contact. There was no denial of that. His argument at trial was, I had no unlawful sexual contact with the victim during these discrete periods when I was the chaperone, when I was supervising her while she was horseback riding at my house, and during, he would have us take each discrete event and take it out of the broader context of the fact that she had known him since she was 9 or 10, her parents, and welcomed him to their home. He had meals with them. He spent time with them. He tutored them on their homework. He was involved in their small, close-knit church. He was involved in youth and children church activities. So the victim would have viewed him as a leader within the church. There's all this broader context. So I don't think you can then pull out, okay, well, we admit he was in a position of trust on this day when he was chaperoning her, but the next day he was no longer in that position.
Could I follow up on that? Just one, right at the end of your opposing counsel's argument, I thought there was a suggestion on her part that the sexual contact took place only at times when the victim was not permitted to be in the presence of the defendant. Was the record to that effect?
I think we could say that there were instances where they specifically said, she asked permission to go horseback riding his house. They said, okay. And during those instances, there was no unlawful sexual contact. They would meet when she was running. However, I think in the context, the broader overall relationship, I think that was still an overarching position of trust. This family, while they said that they didn't trust their daughters around men, welcomed them to the home, admitted that they had no real problem with the defendant. And when they found out about the abuse, both the mother and father said, were shocked, because they said, we have trusted him, we have given responsibilities. The father was the pastor in the church in which the defendant was given responsibilities working with children and youth. It was a very unique relationship. It doesn't fall neatly into a category, but I think the expansive language of the position of trust definition, which starts out with includes but not limited to these specific...
Let me ask you a little more specifically about that, but just so we can narrow this down. And if you had a situation in which any sexual contact took place during times in which the victim said, I want to go over to the defendant's house, I want to go out with the defendant, I want to do whatever, and the parents said, absolutely not, don't do that. She snuck out the bedroom and went and met with the defendant. Would you still consider the defendant to be in a position of trust?
That's a hypothetical I hadn't thought of last night when I was obsessing about this. I think it would depend on the context of the relationship as a whole. I think there can be a broader charge. For example, if the child snuck out of the house and ran into their teacher while they were riding their bike, and it was maybe on summer break or on Christmas break, I think we would probably view that overarching relationship as still putting this person in a position of trust. I think the significance of this designation and the reason the legislature put it in place is we're worried about these adults who have unique access to and control of and are viewed by these children in a special way that gives them extra access to these kids, and they're very vulnerable. And I think
that's an interesting point. The trust, of course, is owed to the child. That's established by the relationship.
Exactly. If you look at the prior case law addressing this position of trust language, some of it suggests that it's so broad that it could apply to any instance in which an adult is alone with a child, because the adult is essentially in charge of that child at that point. I don't think we have to have that broad a reading.
And it's the creation of the duty on the part of the adult to the child that, in effect, is the prescribed crime, right?
This does seem to be pretty unlimited as you're starting to pose it here. I mean, would that carry over then, that if an adult said to the child, let's run off and elope and have an illicit sexual relationship and we're going to go to Mexico, and that was clearly forbidden, but if the child does it, surely you wouldn't be saying that that would be a position of trust, would you?
Well, I admit that it's broad, but I don't think we have to read it that broadly here. I think most of these instances do involve cases where the parents give permission for the child to go to the defendant's house or something like that.
Okay, well, then that's important for the case, isn't it?
Here, I think what the parent, The parents were extremely protective of these daughters and lived in a, they lived in a very sheltered environment. But the defendant had essentially been given a seal of approval. He was welcomed into their home. He was given access to their children. There was at least one instance where she went horseback riding alone without her sister. And I think the permission itself might not necessarily be required for it to be the broader
Well, let's turn that around there. In terms of the evidence of this case, did the record indicate that she was forbidden?
I don't think there's ever any instance where she was forbidden from seeing the defendant. She was not allowed to date. We know that. And they were very protective and sheltering of their daughters. They said, we don't really allow them to be alone with men, etc. Yet, the defendant was welcomed essentially as a member of their family. He came and ate with them. He spent time with them. The daughter went horseback. When the daughter went to the house, she went with her sister. So the daughters were allowed to go to his house and go horseback riding together. I think in the victim's eyes, he was not forbidden. In fact, he might have been the only male who was sort of not forbidden because he was given the parental seal of approval. We were allowed to spend time with him. We're not supposed to spend time with teenage boys, and we're not supposed to spend time with other men, but he is accepted by my parents. He is a role model in my church. He has taken me on field trips. I think that's the way we have to look at this relationship. It's not a traditional position of trust situation, but I think this is really what it was designed for, because he took advantage in each instance in which they acknowledged he was in a position of trust. He didn't do anything illegal, but he did things that were questionable. He would hug her, he would kiss her, he would essentially move the sexual nature of a relationship along so that the next time they met secretly, it could progress further. So I think you have to look at that whole context to see, in the victim's eyes, this guy is kind of in charge and my parents trust him, so this is okay. I think that's how the record suggests it developed.
Could you, a little bit along the lines of what Justice Coates is asking about, I think you've discussed how the Johnson Court of Appeals case is consistent, at least, with this, but what's a little more troubling is not so much the general interpretation of the statute, but the facts of Johnson and this case. So I wonder if you could discuss that a little bit. It's troubling to me.
Sure. Johnson was a completely different situation. In Johnson, it was the driving instructor, the victim and the driving instructor were together for 3 days during this driving course. That's how they got to know each other. Then, after the driving course was over, they had exchanged phone calls and eventually met and had sex, like 2 months after the driving course was over. There was no prior relationship. There was no family friend. There was none of this broader overarching layers of relationship. It was only this brief period in which he was the driving instructor. I think that is completely distinct from what we have here. And I think if you look at the breakdown of the position of trust statute, the first part seems to contemplate these broader, more permanent relationships acting as a parent, a guardian, general supervision of the child. The second half seems to contemplate these more temporary and specific instances, the karate teacher, the driving instructor, the substitute teacher. So the statute contemplates both. This is so factually distinct that I don't think they're inconsistent at all. I think the defendant's argument that it was a misapplication of Johnson is wrong. I think that they applied it to a different type of relationship. And one in which the defendant clearly used his role at church. He sent her a note at church saying, I love you. He on the field trip where he was chaperoning her, he took her to the first aid stand because she had a blister, took her off alone, and they kissed. I think he clearly took advantage of and exploited his roles in the church and as a family friend and as a tutor and as a horseback riding supervisor to further the relationship. And I think that's what the position of trust designation is designed to get at.
This is really a factual determination for the jury.
Absolutely. I think the Court of Appeals correctly construed the statute, and in fact, I think they gave it a truer reading than the Johnson Court. The Johnson Court was very narrow. I think the court in this case recognized the expansive nature and recognized the included but not limited to, and gave it a reading necessary given the depth and complexity of the relationship the victim and the child had, or the defendant and the child had in this case. Trying to think. You know, and another component which we haven't dealt with a lot is the fact that he was a firefighter, I think, also plays into it. He, as a firefighter, was sort of given a general charge by the community. And the parents, in talking about their trust in the defendant, pointed out that we felt that anytime she was with him, we knew he could handle emergencies. We knew he could take care of her. So I think all these components, Sunday school teacher, chaperone, puppet ministries leader, youth leader, firefighter, tutor that came to the house to help the kids with homework, all those work together to show that it falls within the definition of position of trust. If there are no questions, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. Case stands.